All right, I'm going to go ahead and call today's meeting of the Faculty Senate on October 1st to order. Pat, can you verify that we have a quorum?
We do have a quorum.
Great, so our first item up for action is adoption of today's agenda. Can I have a motion? Thank you, first and a second, Scott. All in favor of adopting the agenda for today's meeting, say aye. Opposed? All right, agenda is approved. Or adopted. Next up is the approval of our minutes from the September 3rd, 2025 meeting. You can see those on pages 3 through 6, and hopefully you reviewed them ahead of time. If I could have a motion to approve the minutes. Oh, thank you, Felicia. And Emily, second. Any changes, edits, updates? All right, hearing none, all in favor of approving the September 3rd, 2025 minutes, please say aye. Aye. Opposed? Abstentions? All right, minutes are approved. Pat, do we have any public comment?
Virginia Naples has asked to make a public comment.
All right, and as you come up, you can use this mic if you'd like. We'll have 5 minutes and we'll have a timer for you when you start. Perfect.
Thank you. I hope you can hear me. I'm going to do something I have never done in public before. I am, for the first time, going to use what I consider to be an obscene phrase. And I'm going also to violate all of the things they tell you about preparing for public comments, is I'm going to give you my opinion. And of course, I've already done it because I said I'm using an obscene phrase, and I'm going to give you the punchline. And the obscene phrase, get ready, employee parking permit fees. And I would really like a show of hands of how many of you end up paying to park to come to work. It seems like the majority. How many of you like to have to pay to park to come to work? How many of you like the amount that you have to pay? And are you aware that the parking fee is only $7 differential from the lowest paid employee who makes a little bit more than $15 an hour, when the living wage in DeKalb is considered to be at least 23 and change, to the highest paid administrative level employee with an average salary of over $200,000. And this seems to be an issue that has gone on for decades. I've been here since the Pleistocene. It has existed the whole time I've been here. I have been severely irritated about it the entire time, and it seems that more and more people are becoming irritated, which is why I decided to take some of your time today to ask for a change in the philosophical policy. And I would like to know why we are being asked to pay this fee, because it is not used to, quote unquote, improve parking lots. At least according to my research, I haven't found that. It is not really very much money with a $400 million a year plus budget. The parking fees, both from faculty and staff, come to about $100,000 or less. So even if you were going to use this money to improve parking facilities, maybe you could make 5 or 6 better quality parking spaces. You could put a little gravel around. You could put some black bubble gum kind of things to do crack filling, stuff like that. But it really wouldn't get you very far. And what it has done is it has made people very angry and very unhappy for a very long period of time. If people's attitudes could be translated into dollar amounts, and you talk about the university wanting to get the greatest amount bang for buck, the amount of irritation that the parking fees have cost has cost the university a tremendous amount of angst and anger for bang for the buck. And I've talked to many people over a long periods of time, and every one of them feels disrespected, feels unheard. And so I'm going to give you my punchline today. I am asking our illustrious administration to abolish parking fees for faculty and staff. The reason I came up with this idea to bring it to you at the moment is that I've been sitting in on the negotiations with the AFSCME union, and they asked for a fee study committee to be put forward. And so far, and I don't know the final answer, but so far they appear to have been stonewalled. I told the bargaining group leader that they were asking the wrong question, and that the wrong question should be, why are we being asked to pay to park to come to work? And other industries and businesses don't do that, except of course, if you are in a city and you don't have parking facilities. NIU's got nothing but acres and acres of acres and acres. Some of the parking areas are not great, but they do exist. And so the monies don't seem to go to improve them. And it seems to be causing an inordinate amount of grief. Our administration could become heroes in the eyes of many of us as staff and faculty if they would be amenable to doing this to make us feel a little bit more valued. The other thing that is making this worse is that if you don't get on campus by about 8:20, 8:15 in the morning, if you've got 9 o'clock obligations or 8:30 obligations, the chances of getting a decent parking space that are convenient or that would be convenient to get to a 9 o'clock obligation is not there. I had a Monday, Wednesday, and Friday overload class at 9 a.m. in Montgomery Hall, and there were several times that I ended up getting here late, not through my own fault. If I woke up later, fine, that's on me. But there would be traffic jams, there were accidents, there were delays, there were detours and things like that. And a couple of times, I didn't get there until 8:45, 8:20, or 8:50 or something like that, ended up in the parking garage. Now, I like to walk. I use that as a way of getting exercise. Happy to do it. Not when I have to be at a class at 9 o'clock. And this happened to me numerous times. The administration would really like to have our students and our staff and faculty have a good experience. I think everybody here would agree with that. I certainly do. But how good of an experience is it for a group of 100 students in an introductory biology class who are sitting there frustrated waiting because their professor can't show up to teach class because she can't find a parking space, even though she left at 7:30 in the morning for a 40-minute drive. So thank you. I just wanted to get my 2 cents worth in. With inflation, maybe it's 15 cents. But I ask everybody's help to try to get our administration to listen to what we are saying about this and to make life better for everybody in the university community. Thank you.
All right, thank you, Virginia. That brings us to the Faculty Senate President's announcements, item 6. I hope that everybody is doing well as homecoming activities are underway. On that front, I want to once again remind everyone here that NIU that the faculty are hosting an NIU faculty homecoming block party meetup. This is a collaborative effort out of Division of Academic Affairs and out of the Faculty Senate and other bodies on campus and OERD trying to bring faculty into community with each other and with campus and with the homecoming experience. So that will be tomorrow from 5 to 7. If you haven't already shared the information that I've passed out virtually to this group, please do with your academic unit and encourage your colleagues to join. I will be there if that's any sort of enticement, along with my wife and my 2 kids, you can get to know them and see them. But I hope to see you all there tomorrow, 5 to 7, at the homecoming block party meetup for faculty and staff, and students are more than welcome to join as well. As you may remember, last meeting, we voted on adding the signature of NIU's Faculty Senate to a statement which was in support of the core mission and shared values of higher education. While this passed with a large majority, it was not universal. It was not unanimous. We had 41 yeses, 4 noes, and 1 abstention. And while there is no public deliberation or conversation about the topic, I wanted to understand folks' perspectives on both why they voted for, why they abstained, and why they were opposed to it. So I sent out an anonymous survey to better understand the perspectives of those folks in this room. The goal of that survey was really to help me learn, to make sure I'm understanding other perspectives and that I can best advocate and represent the Faculty Senate, which is representative of faculty broadly on campus. And I wanted to make sure that I'm modeling ways to dialogue across difference. Just because I happen to be one of those who voted for the statement doesn't mean that my voice is the only one that matters. There's voices that were in opposition or maybe didn't agree for the same reasons with the statement. And I wanted to show a willingness and model a willingness to continue dialogue, particularly when we disagree. I think that's the most productive times to do that. And I wanted to make sure that I'm providing opportunities to engage in the dialogue that look differently, because not everybody wants to get up in front of a mic and share a perspective that they may perceive as being out of step with others or without of step with the majority, or otherwise feel not comfortable speaking in a public place to share their perspective. So I wanted to provide that opportunity. I received 4 responses to that survey, and there was multiple points of view that were included in those surveys. And I really do appreciate those who helped me learn and understand better what a few of those voices were. For those who did respond, do feel free to reach out if you'd like to follow up in that conversation in a manner, in a place, in a time that works best for you, because I want to continue deepening my understanding and sharing my perspective with folks as well, because I have reasons beyond what I shared when I introduced the item, but I am always happy to engage in dialogue, particularly when we disagree. I think that's the most engaging and interesting and important work that we can do as members of higher ed or as citizens or as humans, is to work across differences through dialogue and through engagement. I have 2 updates related to the topic of academic freedom. First, you'll notice that we do not have a second reading of Article 4 revisions on the agenda for today. That's intentional, it's not a mistake. After the conversation we had and some of the concerns and topics that were brought up, the Faculty Rights and Responsibilities Committee members met in their meeting and wanted a chance to engage and address and improve the article revisions that came before this body. So they asked for time to do that, to be able to address the concerns that were raised in this public space. So I've honored that request and asked that the group brings forward recommendations to revise Article 14. And the intended timeline is no later than February 4th, and that allows us to bring forward a brand new first reading of those revisions and then have a second reading and a vote, so that we can make sure that we improve our academic freedom grievance process for campus this academic year. So I appreciate the work of those that committee, and I look forward to seeing the updates that come forward related to Article 14. The second thing related to academic freedom, and it was shared with this group and in other formats, we are running a conversational series and book study on academic freedom this semester. We had our first in-person meeting on September 6th or 26th, and we had 10 folks in attendance, and it represented a number of colleges, divisions, and roles on campus. And I thought it was a good first conversation and engagement where we focused on introducing ourselves and why we were there, doing some level setting, and discussed how to approach the book study portion of this, of that series. I'll be sharing information with this group in the meeting summary. If anybody would like to jump into that work or you have colleagues that might be interested, please share that information out. The next meeting will likely be on October 30th, and we'll discuss the first half of the Academic Freedom from Professional Norm to First Amendment Right book by David Rabban. And then we'll do the second half of that later in this semester. My last announcement is the calls for the categories of presidential professorship are open, and they're open until October 6th, so you have a little bit of time yet. So I'll share those links in the summary I send out, and I encourage you to think about your colleagues or yourself as eligible folks who may fit into those professorships. So please look for that and consider nominating a colleague for those really great awards that elevate the great work that faculty are doing on campus. And with that, that concludes my announcements, and I will invite up Provost Elish Piper for your announcements.
Thank you. I want to start with just some enrollment highlights. You probably heard that our 10-day count has come and gone, but I wanted to amplify some of the really positive trends that we're seeing in terms of enrollment, and also to clarify the vital role that not just enrolling new students, but retaining and re-enrolling continuing students played in the progress that we made, and also to express gratitude for the work that you do to help support the recruitment, the retention, and the success of students. So overall, we were up 4.3% in students, which is a really positive component, 22% up in new freshmen. We were also up 11% in new transfer students. That's the third year in a row that we've been up in new transfer students. So that trend has been sustained. You're probably wondering about graduate enrollment. And while we were down a tick overall in graduate enrollment, if you break it down, it's really due to the decrease in international graduate students. We were down about 19% in international graduate students. Although we were up slightly in domestic graduate students, when you put it all together, it caused us to be down overall. But a real bright spot with graduate enrollment is that we were at a five-year high for re-enrollment, meaning that we had more graduate students who were persisting and making progress toward completing their degrees. In addition to that, our incoming freshman class, if we can kind of roll up there, in terms of academic excellence, we had one of the most qualified class of new freshmen that we've had in a long time. This is the highest GPA that we have on record. We've tied this before, but you can also see some of the other accolades there in terms of the percentage of students who earned merit scholarships, as well as 18% had 4.0s, which is really quite an accomplishment when you look at the academic qualifications of our incoming freshman class. Some other historic milestones, we officially became a Hispanic serving institution. And while currently there's not federal funding that's going to flow for Hispanic serving institutions, it does clarify our commitment to serving this. And as we know, a Hispanic serving institution is really committed to serving all students and making sure that opportunities and resources are available for all students to succeed. So that was an important accomplishment as well. In addition to that, our percentage of first generation students continues to increase. Our freshman class, 56% of them were the first in their family to come to college. So our access mission and our affordability continues as we serve more and more first generation students. In addition to that, we were up with new freshman retention by 3%, which was very, very good news. In addition to that, we had the highest re-enrollment rate for undergraduate students that we've had in 25 years. And so re-enrollment looks at all students who are eligible to re-enroll, not just freshmen. So that was really positive as well. So again, that's a place where everyone in this room contributes to that in so many ways, in the ways that you engage your students for advising and mentoring in class, outside of class, co-curricular experiences, the ways that you deliver your curriculum, all of those things truly matter. So I wanted to take this opportunity to thank you for that and also to ask you to take that back to your colleagues. In addition to that, some really interesting things. If campus feels a little more crowded, it is. We have almost 4,500 students living on campus, which is the highest number that we've had in over a decade. So that's been really positive and exciting. In addition to that, I was really pleased to see that we have students from all 50 states, from the District of Columbia, from Puerto Rico, and from 104 countries. So our campus is truly diverse in terms of that, but most of our growth was with Illinois students. That's a trend that we're asking other institutions if they saw that as well. We know that a number of years ago during the budget impasse, there was great concern that more and more students were leaving the state to go to college outside of Illinois. And so we're seeing an increase here in most of our growth being Illinois students. And so we're hoping to see that maybe that trend is taking place at other institutions as well. And perhaps Illinois is stemming the tide of being one of the top exporters of college students. And maybe as a state, we're making progress toward being able to keep more of our Illinois high school graduates in Illinois for college. In addition to that, you can see some other numbers there as well. Our law school had the highest enrollment on record, which is exciting in that regard. I know they're bursting at the seams. And then also we had a pretty significant increase in new honor students. We know that our honor students tend to persist and be very, very successful. So seeing this population grow makes sense when you look at the other data that I shared about the GPA, about the percentage of the students getting merit scholarships and the percentage of students coming to us with 4.0s. And so a number of really, really positive aspects of enrollment that I just wanted to make sure I had an opportunity to share with you and also to thank you for your valuable contributions to making all those things happen. I have three quick ones to share with you. This is kind of my standing one. As we are barely in the fall semester, we're thinking about books for the spring semester. We want to make sure that we get those book orders in as early as possible to make sure that students have access to the books and materials they need to be successful in their courses. The target date for submitting those is November 1st. So if you can take that back to your colleagues and do what you can to get as close to that date as possible, With the quick turnaround for spring semester, the holidays, all of those things, it does make it difficult sometimes to get those books ready to be available for students. So November 1st is the target date. There's an opportunity if you would like to submit a course to have a community engaged designation. That application is open. And when Ben does his follow-up notes, we'll put the link in there in case you want to read more about that. That can be done at the section level or it can be done at the course level. And so if you are teaching community engaged course and want to have the opportunity for students to be able to find it and also to have it be available for students to have transcripted, this is an opportunity to do that. In addition to that, I'm sure that you heard that the federal government has shut down. And so I just wanted to take a moment to say that our Director of Federal Relations in Washington, D.C. is closely monitoring and sharing information with us. In addition to that, we've been in communication with the governor's office because we know that the impact of the federal government on the state budget also affects us, as well as connecting with professional associations like the Association of Public and Land Grant Universities and other national organizations that are tracking the impact. I know that our colleagues in the Division of Research and Innovation Partnership have been and will continue to be in communication with individuals who have federal funding to see what the impact might be on them and their projects. In addition to that, we've been closely working, and right now there's not an impact on financial aid or federal work study, but we're continuing to track those because those are also programs that could impact us, especially as the shutdown might extend. So just wanted to let you know that we're looking at those things and we'll continue to share out information as it becomes available. So thank you.
Thank you. That takes us to item 8, which are items for Faculty Senate consideration. I'd like to invite up Amy Burrow, who's the Assistant Vice Provost for Assessment and Accreditation, to give us an update on General Education Committee work.
Thanks, Ben. Okay, good afternoon, everyone. I'd like to start by saying thank you for giving me this opportunity to share information about our general education program and its assessment. Over the next 10 minutes or so, I'm going to share a lot of information. And if you want to dive into the details in real time, feel free to go to the QR code, which will take you to the general education website. Or just know that that information is out there. If you do a general education search on NAU, you'll be able to find it later. Taking pictures, so I want to pause for a second. Okay, because I'm here to share information about assessment, I think it's really important that we ground the conversation in what our general education program is trying to do in regards to student learning. Excuse me. These 8 student learning outcomes serve a dual purpose. They describe the knowledge, skills, and abilities all NIU students are supposed to achieve as a result of their baccalaureate degrees. And they describe the knowledge, skills, and abilities students are expected to achieve as a result of the general education program. Our Gen Ed program lays the foundation for the knowledge, skills, and abilities, and coursework in the majors really build on that foundation in the upper division. Our NIU Gen Ed program requires 33 credit hours. 12 of those hours are in the foundational studies areas of writing, oral communication, and quantitative literacy. 18 credit hours use a distributive model where students choose 6 credit hours in each of 3 knowledge domains: creativity and critical analysis, nature and technology, and society and culture. Students fill the remaining 3 credit hours with an elective from any of the knowledge domains based on their interests. The General Education Committee is a subcommittee of the Baccalaureate Council. And the GEC is responsible for monitoring and evaluating our Gen Ed program, as well as overseeing improvements to its policies, procedures, and design. And those improvements are ongoing. Most of the time, they're in the form of adding courses. But the bigger changes result from the GEC constantly asking the question, is our general education program serving its purpose? This slide summarizes some of the major improvement initiatives that have happened over the last 5 years. You can find more details of each online if you want to dig in. There are 3 that I really want to highlight today that are pertinent to the assessment conversation. First, in 22-23, there was an initiative to intentionally align each general education course to one or more baccalaureate student learning outcomes. The foundational studies courses were assigned a single student learning outcome, and courses in the knowledge domain were assigned a primary outcome and asked to choose a secondary outcome from a predefined list from their knowledge domain. Then in fall 2023, the GEC reviewed a whole lot of data on our gen ed courses. They looked at who was teaching the gen ed courses and found that it's a pretty even mix of faculty and instructors with some GAs and staff. They looked at the knowledge domain courses home college, and I don't think anyone will be surprised to hear that 63% come from the College of Liberal Arts and Sciences. They looked at the level of courses and found that most are in the lower division, but the number of 100 and 300 level classes are about the same. There's a difference of 5. I was surprised at that. They looked at the class size and found that of the 235 courses offered over the last 5 years, 67% had 49 or fewer students, and 88% had 99 or fewer. They finished by surveying students and faculty on their perspectives on the purpose and structure of our gen ed program. Then they took all of this information and formed a task force in spring of 2024. And that task force created a philosophy for our general education program and some guiding principles. Here's the philosophy that was adopted. It focuses on 3 fundamental purposes: skills, knowledge, and exploration. The foundational studies courses develop foundational, transferable skills and career-ready competencies. The knowledge domain courses develop basic knowledge and broader insights. And our general education program as a whole is meant to unleash student curiosity. To guide General Education Committee decisions, these 10 principles were adopted. The Gen Ed program is intentional and student-centered. Courses balance learning across skills, knowledge, and exploration. The general education program supports the baccalaureate student learning outcomes. Courses in the knowledge domains are mapped to specific baccalaureate student learning outcomes, and they assess those learning outcomes. Courses in the knowledge domains should not have any prerequisite courses or prerequisite or co-requisite. Courses should intentionally position the course from multiple perspectives. Courses should, to the extent possible, engage in high impact practices. On those last 3, I want to highlight the use of the word should. That was very intentional. The General Education Committee recognizes the uniqueness of each course and takes those circumstances into consideration if they have prerequisites or if they have co-requisites, just depending on what that course is trying to do and how it fits within the gen ed program. Principle number 8 is that courses will be offered at least every 4 years. And 9, they'll be reviewed at least every 4 years. And finally, instructors and teaching assistants are supported by a community of practice. So if you teach in the general education program and haven't attended an EDGE meeting, monthly meetings hosted by CITL, I would encourage you to do so. They're great conversations on how we can really enrich the experiences in our gen ed program. Again, I want to draw some special attention to guiding principles number 3 and 4, which deal with assessment, because these were the 2 that really guided the General Education Committee's work in 24-25. And so we're on the same page. Assessment is the systematic gathering of information about student learning for the improvement of student learning. It's action research, and it's intended to inform local and central improvement decisions. It focuses on gathering data on the most critical indicators, not every indicator. That data can be used as the basis for curricular and pedagogy decisions, staffing, advising, student support, any action that is taken with the intention to improve student learning. But I think the most important thing to note is assessment's the start of a conversation. It's a conversation about what we want our students to know or be able to do as a result of their education, how we intend to teach them, what success looks like, and what happens when our students fall short of that vision. I mentioned previously the work done to align courses to the student learning outcomes. In doing so, we also align the courses to rubrics specific to each student learning outcome. In the foundational studies, it's a one-to-one relationship. Each course was assigned a single student learning outcome, which has a single corresponding rubric. In the knowledge domains, it's 2-to-1. Each course was assigned a primary student learning outcome based on the knowledge, and you can the knowledge domain, and you can see that in column 2. Then they were given the choice of 2 learning outcomes to select from. Again, each one of those outcomes comes with a corresponding rubric. You know, for example, my home college is business, so I'm most familiar with that. So I'm going to use the business example. UBiz 110, Business in Action, is a course in the creativity and critical analysis domain. That domain is assigned demonstrate critical, creative, and independent thought as their primary student learning outcome. Then the college decided that using combined appropriate quantitative and qualitative reasoning skills best aligned as their secondary student learning outcome. When those faculty go to assess those general education student learning outcomes, they would use the critical thinking and qualitative reasoning rubrics. That way we are measuring consistently and we have data that we can aggregate and make decisions on at a central level. It's important to note that our rubrics were created in the late 2010s. I can't really put my finger on the exact date, so some of you in the room may have been involved in that. They used the AACNU value rubrics as their foundation, and then faculty customized those to our context and our curriculum. Each rubric identifies criteria that break down those knowledge, skills, and abilities into more discrete assessment indicators. And we use 4 behavioral anchors to really describe the behaviors we would expect to see at each of those levels. While we don't expect Gen Ed courses to cover every single assessment indicator on the rubric, we would expect that they would cover a good number of them. What we learned through discussions with faculty while planning our fall 2024 assessment pilots with math and comms and some conversations with psych was that while a course might align to the spirit of the student learning outcome, the rubrics really didn't reflect what was happening in the context of those courses. And that raises some red flags. So given that, the General Education Committee, together with university assessment panel members, formed task forces for each rubric last fall and spring to benchmark what other institutions were doing along similar learning outcomes and suggest revisions. This fall, we'd like to offer faculty campus-wide the opportunity to discuss and review those revisions. We plan to target invitations to faculty to those who've taught those courses over the past 2 years, the courses that are aligned to each outcome. So in addition to that, we would invite broadly through NIU Today, the Provost Post, really encouraging broad participation. Because as I said earlier, the Gen Ed courses lay the foundation, but all of the courses in the upper division build on that foundation. So these rubrics need to be relevant to the constructs we're trying to measure. You might notice there are no dates attached to the communication rubrics. That's because there is a single course that aligns with oral communication and a handful of courses from one department that align with written communication. So we're going to rely on those faculty to lead those discussions and those revisions. We're starting with quantitative and qualitative reasoning because we're expanding the fall 2024 pilot assessment project to include all foundational courses in our data collection efforts this fall. In that quantitative reasoning foundational studies area. So all of those math courses, the stats courses, and UBiz 223. And so we need to get the rubric done first so that we can map assignments, tests, et cetera. Critical thinking and intercultural competencies in human life and natural world will follow because we've identified a handful of high enrollment courses that we want to target for data collection for those student learning outcomes in the spring. So I've given you a lot of information to really wrap up, to ask you a question. How can we encourage faculty participation in this conversation this fall beyond emails to very busy people with very full inboxes? And I'd also take any questions if you have them.
Can you come to the mic? Sorry.
Thinking maybe how you can encourage it, maybe start attending or have a representative from your office attend some of the faculty meetings monthly. I know, you know, that's having a guest speaker who might come in and elicit some answers to a question can be potentially helpful. Thank you.
And I mean, part of, oh, yeah, please come on up. Grab a mic. Thank you.
I'm Iman Salinio from Mechanical Engineering. So one thing that I'm just very curious is that what is being like covered in these courses? So as a faculty, I really don't know. Like when you say critical thinking, it's a big word. And there are like a lot of research that shows that critical thinking is actually not happening, especially during the class time for many students. Actually, there's a research, they put a lot of like sensors on the student's head and they didn't see anything, any signals actually during the class time. So I'm just very curious that what is going on in these classes first, and then hopefully then we can actually go into the rubric review conversation. So that would be nice if you can actually bring something to different colleges and show us what is actually being covered in this class.
Thank you for that. And I would say you just were a great commercial for why faculty should participate in these, because there are over 250 courses in the general education program, and everybody is going to cover critical thinking a little bit different. I can speak from my College of Business experience of problem solving and how that's defined. The rubrics really have to be broad enough to capture how it happens across our very diverse disciplines. It can't be specific and so granular to a specific framework or a specific discipline. That's why we need the broad participation. And I don't think we can get that from syllabi. I think we have to have the conversations. So I hope to see you there. So I gave you a lot to think about. I am going to share a Qualtrics link with Ben and Pat to distribute to you later. So as you process all of this, if you come up with any great ideas, let us know. For this to be successful, we need broad participation from faculty and lots of perspectives. So thank you again for the opportunity.
Yeah, thank you so much, Amy. And I really appreciate the perspective that this is foundational to our students' experiences and what we are helping our students as they grow through their time with us. These Gen Ed courses are a program that cuts across the university. It's a little different than I usually think about programs, which is the one that I teach in directly and I cultivate in my department, that we do this work locally and maybe more customized and all that kind of stuff. And we think about it as part of our, like the rhythm and routines of our work, of our self-assessment and critical analysis. This is a collective process that is campus-wide that we need to work collectively to determine how we collect relevant data and then how do we use it, and this is a core point. So thank you, Amy. All right, that brings us to our reports from councils, boards, and standing committees. We have a report from the Faculty Advisory Council to IBHE from Tiffany Puckett. So thanks.
Good afternoon. I hope everyone is doing well. The last FAC meeting was hosted by University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign on September the 19th. It was a great meeting with, and it was our first meeting of the school year with various highlights, and I'll highlight some things, but that report will be available for you to read everything that's on it online on our website. But the meeting started out with Vice Provost Kevin Jackson giving an update with a panel about different things that University of Illinois was doing. One of the interesting things that everybody seemed to be talking about is they're now in the business of doing dual credit. So they have, they've started a dual credit program with some funding from American Talent Innovation, where they have partnered with their College of ACES, and they're partnering to create access to college credits for rural communities or communities that students might have high schools that are free and reduced lunch. So these students have opportunity to take college courses through the University of Illinois. One of the things that came up was what about the community colleges? Because that's typically what they do. And they did say that they do have a community college right of refusal. So they will give notice to the community colleges that are to that local high school that they're partnering with. Right now, they have two high schools that they're partnering with, but they're going to do it with up to 10 high schools. So they'll reach out to those local community colleges and say, hey, this is a course we want to teach. You know, are you teaching it? And it'll give them an opportunity to refuse to allow University of Illinois to teach that class. And their goal for that is to increase access to college credit for students in those areas that might not have access to that. So some of the IBHE updates, the IBHE Workforce Insight Dashboard is now up and running. If you have not had a chance to look at it, just Google Workforce Insight Dashboard. It's a new database that came out of a strategic plan, but it's pretty cool because it gives a snapshot of the workforce in Illinois. One of the interesting features is it has the top 10 in demand occupations. So for folks who are looking into workforce, that would be a good tool for you to look at. There was more updates given regarding Illinois' One Click program, which is the new admissions program, which is the pilot program will go into effect next year, where students will automatically be admitted into public four-year universities based on their GPA only. For that first year, all the universities, four-year universities in Illinois will be participating except for University of Illinois Chicago, University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, and Illinois State University. And then in the 2027, Illinois State University is going to participate in that. And everybody has different GPAs on what the automatic admissions will be. University of Illinois system, Springfield will participate, but the other two will not. But they will use this program as a outreach to reach out to students at this point. Other reports from the board has not formally come out yet and formally endorsed any type of equitable fundable legislation. I know we talked about a lot of that last year if you were on Faculty Senate. And then also IBHE is trying to expand student success and student success programs. So they have hired three new positions. And so those positions, I believe, are live for application. So if you know someone who might be interested in having a position with IBHE related to student success, they are up to 60 people working in that office now. And I've been told that there are going to be more job postings coming. And then in some of our breakout sessions in our four-year university caucus meetings, we just spent a lot of time talking about things going on. It was exciting to announce that we had an increase in our enrollment and the excitement on campus and the spirit on campus. Thank you. Does anybody have any questions?
Yeah. Thank you, Tiffany. All right, next up is the University Advisory Committee to Board of Trustees report. The Board of Trustees met in the Committee of the Whole on September 25th. The Board of Trustees voted to approve all the committee recommendation action items, which were mentioned at our last Faculty Senate meeting, including software contract renewals, a new approach to EAMMC agreements with external vendors, and the bulk purchasing of laptops and desktops from Dell. We also had a great presentation overview from Dr. Iman Salahini from Mechanical Engineering about the College Success Series, which I will be plugging here as well. I know you asked BOT to plug it. I'll plug it here for you as well. But it's designed to support student success based on student feedback and best practices. And so it's a great example of a lot of the faculty. It's one example of the great faculty work to support our students and then obviously the staff that work to support our students. But I think it's a great way to elevate how folks bring their passion for our students to bear into to ways that support not just their students, but all of campus and beyond our walls. So that was a great presentation. Is there anything else to add from the BOT? All right. We have then no reports from the Baccalaureate Council, from the Faculty Rights and Responsibilities Committee, the Social Justice Committee, or the Rules, Governance, and Elections Committee. Nathan, do we have a report from SGA? Okay, so next up is our SGA Association report from Nathan Gonzalez, who's the Speaker of the Senate.
Greetings. I'm just going to keep this very brief. So far, Student Government Association has been focused on currently implementing and revising internal policies. This is mostly for us to give ourselves peace of a head, but also this is so we can eventually focus on, which we're beginning to do, onto more impactful and lasting impacts and policy changes that we want to enact that aligns with the sentiments I expressed during last Faculty Senate report. For example, I've been working with the president of DePaul University Student Government Association president, Priyanshu Bahadur, which some of those conversations actually led to some of our internal policy revisions. But specifically, those acts that we want to do are related to working with other university student governments, like what was done last year that was reported to this body in November of 2024 with the intercollegiate panel. But also additionally, I want to specifically state that those conversations will also help SGA guide us in turbulent times. I am due to speak with President Bahadur from DePaul, specifically regards to the government shutdown, indicating that this is something that we are keeping ahead of, and it is something that SGA is keenly aware and in tune with.
Thank you, Nathan. Operating Staff Council, do we have a report? Gigi? Yeah, all right, thank you, Gigi.
Hello. The Operating Staff Council has met twice since I was elected to represent them. The president is Jim Slagstead. The vice president is Jay Montero. The treasurer, it was elected Kathy Mosier. The secretary is Tracy Ward, and the parliamentarian is Cindy Krasumplik. At the August 7th meeting, we just basically went through the elections and the elections and assignments to the committees. At the 9-4 meeting, we had a presentation from Lori Eilish Piper, who spoke to us about using AI to do weekly check-ins with students. Academically well-being, she reported that 96% of the students opted into this program. And then a real person follows up with the student, depending on the topic. We found that particularly interesting. It was also brought to our attention that we are now officially a Hispanic-serving institution, which means that 25% of our population is now Hispanic. So that's a great accomplishment for NIU. The committee was requesting peer interaction for new employees, mentoring connections, and a program similar to what the Faculty Senate does for mentoring faculty. We would like to work with the provost's office to get that set up, and we're working towards that goal. We also held a moment of silence for someone that many of you might know, Pat Wallace has passed away. We had a moment of silence for her. Pat was very involved. She is a long-term employee of the institution. She was very involved in many of the things in the committees that that we do here on campus. So many of you may have known her. And that would be concluding my report. I'm Gigi Beard, and the other member elected to represent the Operating Staff Committee here in the Faculty Senate is Tamara Boston. I'm not sure if she's in the room, yes, she is, Tamara Boston. And we look forward to working with the Faculty Senate throughout our tenure. Thank you.
Thank you, Gigi, and for persisting through the ringing. Felicia, do we have a report from Supported Professional Staff Council?
So we completed our second meeting of the year, and basically, at this point, we've elected all of our officers, all of our committee spots are filled, and then we spent a large part of our last meeting really focusing on what are the priorities for SPSS staff. And so we basically looked at the survey that we completed last year, and then we're moving forward with a variety of recommendations that came forth from that. One of the primary concerns is in terms of staff pathways. And so we're looking at working with HR as far as that's concerned. We just completed a meeting talking about mentoring in terms of is that an issue for SPSS staff, and is that what would we like to go as far as that's concerned? Thank you.
Thank you, Felicia. All right, that concludes the reports for today. Item 10 are informational items. A through P are the standard ones of minutes, policies, and reports. Item Q is our schedule for the Faculty Senate. You'll see our next meeting is October 29th in 4 weeks. And that brings us to adjournment. Do I have a motion to adjourn today's meeting? Thank you, Novak. Second. Thank you, Scott. All in favor, say aye. Aye. All right, thank you.